This is Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg. KGMI and the Cascade Radio Group receive financial compensation to present this program in its entirety.
The opinions voiced on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are for general information only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what is appropriate for you, consult a qualified professional. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, a registered investment advisor. Carson Partners is a division of CWM LLC, a nationwide partnership of advisors. Guests on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are not affiliated with CWM LLC.
Good Saturday morning. Dick Donahue, Camille Koppenberg with you. We are, well, let's say it this way. Camille's live. I left my window shut so you don't have to listen to the waves. Anyway, here's the weekly recap. Last Friday's the strong jobs report set the stage for a record-breaking week of the Dow Jones Industrial Average and S&P 500 Index. Growth and momentum stocks posted strong results as interest rates eased. The NASDAQ, 3.12% up for the week, led the major indices, followed by the S&P 500, which was up 2.71%. The Dow Jones Industrial was up 1.95%. while the Russell 2000 index declined fractionally, down 0.46%. In March, the U.S. economy added 916,000 jobs, the largest gain since August. The unemployment rate fell to a pandemic low of 6%. Hiring was especially strong in the travel leisure industries as airlines added flights to meet strong demand, and restaurants in many states began to hire staff as COVID-19 restrictions eased. Job openings continued to surge for many companies struggling to hire enough workers. The International Monetary Fund again increased its projected 2021 global growth rate to 6%. Various data support a strengthening economy. The ISM non-manufacturing index is up 63.7%, or is at 63.7%, far exceeded estimates of 58.5% to its highest reading since measurements began in 1997. Also, the March ISM manufacturing index at 64.7% rose to a 38-year high as business activities, new orders, employment components rose. Importantly, the Federal Reserve reiterated its commitment to maintain current monetary policies to ensure a robust economy. Inflation rose 1% in March, above expectations for a modest 0.4% gain. For the week, interest rates eased modestly. Most economists and corporate executives look at the second half of the year for a surge in economic growth as vaccination rates increase and restrictions diminish. California's Governor Newsom indicated this week that all restrictions should end by mid-June. Supply issues remain, however. General Motors announced the plant closures due to a lack of computer chips and shipping bottlenecks. Meanwhile, President Biden's infrastructure proposal faces uncertainty in Congress as negotiations address the filibuster rules, corporate tax hikes, and spending details. The pace of COVID-19 vaccinations remains the most important barometer of economic recovery as cases surge in several states. First quarter earnings season begins next week. Analysts expect strong results as they closely monitor forward-looking commentaries. Certainly, the proposal to increase the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%, incidentally, that sounds like 7%, but it's actually a 33% increase, the total, or perhaps negotiated somewhere in the middle ground, will be an area of concern. There is an increase of 25% would reduce average earnings by approximately 3%. So that's pretty significant. Many investors now ask, where will I find the best returns now that so many companies have enjoyed outsized returns? The positive bias in the markets does remain. Okay, let's talk about some of our COVID tracking information we like to follow every week. And there's a recent CDC study on surface transmission of COVID-19 found that risk was low and that each contact with a contaminated surface has less than a 1 in 10,000 chance of causing an infection. Also, there was new research study at the University of Chicago Medicine has found that it comes to COVID-19 that having vitamin D levels Bubbles traditionally considered sufficient may lower the risk of infection, especially for black people. And another interesting chart this week, number of confirmed COVID-19 cases and deaths by week in U.S. long-term care facilities. Well, to give you an example, back at the end of December, there were 7,000 deaths per week in long-term care facilities. As of March 31st, that had dropped to 500 deaths per week in long-term care facilities, a very significant drop. Also looking at the shares of people that have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine by age, we're going to start out with the 40 to 50-year-olds. That was 31.2%. Those between 50 and 64, about 43.4%. Those that are 65 to 74, almost 70% have gotten at least one dose. Those over 75, almost 75%. The average across the population total is 30.5% of the population has received at least one dose. Also looking at which vaccines are using. To date, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has been had for almost 88,500,000 doses. Moderna is over 78 million doses. And the Johnson & Johnson is about 4,500 doses total that have been administered as of this time. Also looking at the high-frequency data that I follow every week, we found that the initial job claims actually increased last week about 2.2%. We saw the continuing claims, however, at 3,734,000 had dropped or canceled 1%. Also, box office seats between March 26th and April 1st were up another 34%. Rail car traffic as of April 2nd was down about 1.2%. Steel production as of April 5th was actually up about 0.3%. Hotel occupancy for the week ending March of 27th was down about 1%, and revenues as of the same March 27th date were down about 1.5%. We're seeing that the restaurant industry as of April 7th had seen another 3.3% increase in the number of restaurants opening. And the TSA checkpoint data as of April 7th, 1,438,951 were passing through the checkpoints. That was an average for the week. That was up about 3%. And the supply of motor gasoline as of April 2nd had also shown a drop of about 1.2%. That gives you a note in case you're planning on traveling. Left Seattle Monday, went through SeaTac, of course, and the lines were unbelievable. The lines were longer than I'd ever seen them ever. And what was happening, of course, is that's not a Monday. That's not a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday when you'd expect it. The lines were backed up just unbelievably long. They said that the waits were probably 2 hours or more when they took us through. When we went through, we actually went around through TSA pre. That had to go all the way down to the Alaska gate to hit TSA pre. But regular waiting lines are really long, so if you are heading out, keep that in mind if you're heading down to the airport and deciding, hey, it's time to travel, because you're certainly not alone at this point in time. Dick Donahue with you, and we'll wake up on KGMI. We'll be back here after a quick, short break. Thank you for being with us.
Because there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the U.S.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue, Camille Kopenberg with you. We are live. We are kind of in studio. Anyway, we're also asset advisors located out on the Pacific Highway, about halfway out to Ferndale in the Pacific Commerce Center next to Wilson's Furniture. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101, Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. Check out our website at wealthwakeup.com. And Camille, there's some things going on this week. Go for it.
Absolutely. Well, this last week, we had a webinar that was provided by Jamie Hopkins all about college planning. So if you recall, if you were listening to last week's radio show, I talked about 529s and college planning. So we have two resources to check out if you go to wealthwakeup.com. The first, if you go to menu and you go to insights, the first is our free guide. So it's a nice handy dandy checklist. So you can think about the financial milestones for college planning. So things to think about as your kids age, from starting at birth all the way to high school and college. The second item, we wrote a monthly newsletter about how a 529 can help you save for college and invest in the future. And then this upcoming week, you'll see that replay about college planning. And so what we've been doing as far as the materials that we have out there, the resources that we have out there for our clients, is we've been coupling a webinar, a live webinar, in addition to a newsletter, and then a nice little free guide that you can have every month. So April is a big focus on college planning. So check that out. It's wealthwakeup.com. Okay, well, I'm going to talk about prescribing Roth accounts to reduce pre-Medicare premiums. So we, Dick and I, every month get a newsletter that is written by Heather Schreiber about Social Security, and she had a guest expert write an article specifically about people who retire too young, so before Medicare age, before the age of 65. This guest expert is a CPA and talks about the different ways that you can actually prescribe a Roth to help pay for those early premiums. So I want to chat about that a little bit here. When Dick and I typically talk about, for example, Roth conversions with our clients, we talk about what we call jumping brackets, right? Or bracket bumping, where we can convert a regular IRA and also take a look at your tax statement and make sure we're within different tax brackets, so we're not bumping you up to the next tax bracket. So, you know, somebody who's going from a 12% bracket maybe to a 22 to a 24, and then after that 24%, you kind of have a big jump. So we're always very wary about what we're doing there. And that strategy can help our clients reduce their income taxes down in retirement, especially once, you know, your required distributions begin. That's when you have to take money out of a traditional IRA. And generally, our intent there is to keep, you know, funds in the Roth account as long as possible, because we want to kind of earn that tax that we paid and then also have that tax-free growth. But there are other ways that you can use Roth. So as I mentioned, you know, we do actually a big deal of work with people who retire before the age of 65. So they are maybe too young to go on Medicare, right? And they no longer have coverage that's important from an employer's plan. So when we start looking at those costs for health premiums, they can be really high. So a strategy that you may want to think about with a lot of thoughtful planning, especially, but using early funding of Roth accounts and timely Roth withdrawals. And that can actually cut your premium costs from about maybe $20,000 a year down to that $3,600 to $6,000 range. That's pretty big. That's significant. And so people who seek to purchase, you know, an individual or family health insurance, generally what they're going to do is they're going to turn to that federally facilitated health insurance marketplace, you know, healthcare.gov, or maybe a state-based marketplace. And depending on that person's income, premium tax credits that essentially cut health insurance costs might actually be available. That's under the Affordable Care Act. So that would reduce current ACA purpose income that may have a big impact on those premiums that you end up paying. So kind of to better help you understand this, let's take a look at some examples. The first is Mike and Nora. Okay, let's say they both retire at the age of 62 and they're in good health. They don't have a history of cigarette smoking. And Mike and Nora would like to have $100,000 of annual cash flow in their early retirement. Well, based on the health calculators out there, such a married couple would pay about $2,027 per month for family coverage. And that's actually about $24,324 a year. So if they've got $100,000 of Affordable Care Act income, there would be no tax credits to reduce those premiums. They wouldn't be able to reduce those premiums. However, let's say that Mike and Nora could reduce their ACA income to, let's say, $63,000. At that income, the calculator shows marketplace premiums drop down to about $516 per month. So they went from $24,324 a year all the way down to $6,192 a year. And that's a big savings, $18,000 in premiums. In over 3 years, that would be $54,396. So how do they do that? Well, from the perspective of taking out of a Roth, that is not included on your income tax. So that's where you can think about using that Roth account a little earlier than you might have thought of to reduce that income so you can get those health credits when you retire a little earlier than expected, when you retire earlier than 65 years of age. It's a very interesting way to think about planning for retirement, but healthcare is such an expensive cost. It's something that we review every single time that we sit down with our clients. And so the best way to work with us on kind of trying to figure out that planning is, let's say that you're planning to retire, you know, before the age of 65. And like my example, I showed somebody retiring at 62. You want to take a look at how much you're going to have to pay for healthcare and what kind of income that you're showing. So they call that the Affordable Care Act income, where you can get certain credits back. So if you're making a certain amount, in my example, this person dropped from $100,000 to $63,000, and because they dropped that much of reportable income, they were able to get all those credits back. And like I said, that's a big savings. $18,000 in savings is quite a bit. So if you're out there and you're thinking about, okay, how do I think about healthcare if I retire early? Maybe you're, like I said, maybe you're not able to get an extension of COBRA, or you just don't have anything available to you. Then we want to look at that financial planning piece. We want to take a look at your what your taxable income is going to look like, and then help you plan around that. And even before you retire, we want to look at that, because you have to have a Roth account in the first place to even be able to participate. So thinking about those Roth conversions even earlier before retirement is really important there. So if you've got questions about that, or if you need some clarification on how to make that work, I'd love to talk to you. You can give me a call at our office, which is 360-733-1200. And with that,
let me throw two bits worth in here, Camille. It's probably well worth people sitting down and taking a look if they're ever going to do a Roth conversion, simply because of where the tax rates are today and the fact that the Biden administration plans on substantially raising tax rates, and it may affect a lot more people than what they're thinking and saying at this time.
Oh, so
it
absolutely
is a discussion worth having.
Yeah, absolutely. We started out that conversation talking about that's the first thing we usually talk about, but we never think about the healthcare impact. So for sure. Anyway, call us, 360-733-1200, and we'll be right back.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again. Just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live with me, Camille, and Dick Donahue. Before the break there, I was talking about using Roth accounts, We were talking about tax brackets. We were talking about pre-retirees. I'm going to really change gears here and share a story, a blog post, really, that was written by Erin Wood. She is with the Carson Group, and she's the Vice President of Financial Planning and Advanced Solutions. And it's a topic that a lot of people like to talk about. But if you have a daughter out there or experiencing it yourself, it is really important to understand the cost of infertility, especially from a woman's point of view. And so Erin shared in her story that she had struggled with a lot of pregnancy issues and actually was surprised to find out that she wasn't alone. So she had talked to friends, relatives, coworkers, people she had known for years that were suddenly sharing with her a very vital but private part of their life, right? And a lot of people talking about conversation. Oh, you're a financial advisor. Can we go somewhere and talk? They wanted to talk. So the statistic in regards to infertility is that 1 in 8 couples do struggle with infertility. So chances are you probably know somebody who has been, and it's very expensive. This is why we're talking about it on the show. It's an expensive and a pretty tiring journey for a lot of people. So infertility can include a lot of treatments, but the one that people talk about a lot is IVF, so in vitro fertilization. It's one of the more effective, it's more common treatments that are out there. And with a lot of medical procedures that are out there, the cost of IVF can be very difficult to account for. And for a lot of people, they end up spending tens of thousands of dollars. So consider that most people need multiple treatments, right, before achieving live birth. And there's never a guarantee as well that it will actually work. The medications you need to process through can run into the thousands of dollars. And then also, if you're a working person, then you have to think about things like the cost of paid time off. And even, you know, staying near to a clinic that actually offers that to undergo that extensive treatment. So there's actually a group out there that estimates that the cost per cycle is $22,000. But said it's not uncommon for an American couple, right, to spend around $50,000 out of pocket on the treatment. So a lot of questions that go around that on the cost, right? You might think that insurance might cover it, but there are only 15 states that actually require workplace insurance to cover fertility treatments, and coverage, you know, if they do have coverage, it's often limited. And a lot of insurance companies just won't touch the infertility treatments. It's generally categorized as voluntary, and they're therefore usually outside of coverage. They actually did a survey of 10,000 patients and said that 71% said they had no coverage on their treatments. And then the remaining 29% said they had some coverage. So who can actually afford IVF, right? If you're reading this in middle age with a healthy retirement that is gaining ground, you might have $50,000 in liquid assets for a big expense. But what did your liquid assets look like when you were maybe 25 years and younger, right, when you're ready to start that family? The age when most people seek treatment are the years when they're laying the foundations of wealth. So it's not a surprise then that most IVF success stories look the way that you might think, right? So this person is probably upper middle class. They're probably in households making $100,000 or more. And if you're wealthier, you have the income to invest in treatment, whereas those who might not be able to afford it at all. So you might most likely know people who wouldn't probably be able to afford the journey, or maybe they're in the midst of depleting savings, cashing out retirement plans to even make that happen. But there are options for couples who are journeying through IVF to make the price tag maybe a little more approachable, but still pretty difficult. So some things to think about, okay? So even though some insurance companies do not provide that, IVF is considered a qualified health expense for health savings accounts and flexible savings accounts. So if you've got an HSA out there or an FSA, that's probably good news for those couples trying to start a family. So your HSA in particular is a triple taxed advantage plan. It's a powerful tool for protecting your wealth from medical expenses. So you build your HSA fund through your contributions, and it only can grow at a certain rate. So you're at an advantage if you've been saving for lots of years versus maybe when you learn you need that medical assistance to conceive in the first place. So it's true that many couples have only had a few years to a decade to build their HSAs at that point, right? You were talking about those 25 to 35-year-olds out there. The current contribution limit also for an HSA, if you're not aware, is $7,100 per year. That's for family. On the flip side, there's also a plan called the FSA, and that is a tax-deductible account you can contribute to from your paycheck. That annual contribution allowed is $2,750 per FSA. So let's say that there's both spouses and they have an FSA through their respective employers. That would allow them to elect a maximum of $5,500 per household. So as long as the expenses are qualified, those withdrawals are tax-free. Now, the biggest difference between an FSA and an HSA is that the FSA has to be used by the end of the calendar year. It is really a use it or lose it situation. And a lot of employers are going to have a little bit of a grace period of a few months or maybe some carryover. And then the HSA, on the other hand, is always going to be yours no matter what, even after you leave that employer. So if you're out there, if you've got an HSA or an FSA, it does help defray the cost of IVF. And then, as I mentioned, in those limiting amounts, it's not going to ever cover the entire bill for most couples. I kind of want to move on to tax deductions. So if you itemize your taxes, you can receive a tax deduction for medical expenses over 7.5 of your adjusted gross income. Now, a lot of people don't see that because it's hard to get there. But a tax deduction can work within your plan. So if you're thinking about this, or you've got a daughter or granddaughter who's working through this, you can talk to them about a tax deduction in their financial plan to prepare for the bill. And what you want to do when it comes to IVF and you're thinking about it is to include all the bills to take you over that 7.5 threshold. So an example of that, I like to use examples to clarify. Let's say that you make $100,000 and then you incur $40,000 in medical expenses via IVF in 2021. Awesome. You've hit the 7.5 threshold, which at that income is $7,500. What that means is that you can deduct the excess of that amount for your medical expenses. That's why it's so hard to get, because it's the excess. So in this case, that would be $32,500 because that expense was $40,000. So anything over that 7.5 is deductible. So all of a sudden you weren't itemizing, now you can. And since the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the minimum standard deduction is set at 24.8. So deducting $32,500 is an improvement on that end, right? So you're over that $24,800 hump. Now you've got a $32,500 tax deduction, which can be a big benefit when you're facing such a large expense like IVF. So you want to talk, you know, anytime we're talking about these different tax strategies, you want to talk with a financial advisor. I've talked about this before, but we have such a great program at our office where we can take anyone's tax return and throw in those different scenarios to show you some of the benefits or some of the things that you should be thinking about. If you're on this journey, or you know somebody who is on this journey, there are a lot of specialized loans and shared risk programs that have emerged are also grants that exist. If you look up the article that Erin wrote, it is on our website. She's got links to those specialized loans, those shared risk groups. There is also a Nest Egg Foundation to help people to qualify. And so financial help for IVF does exist out there. It takes a lot of planning, a lot of patience, and it's a long process. It's not as simple as throwing down some insurance and then being able to find that. And then lastly, Erin did note in her blog post, she's got a really adorable daughter. And so just the fact that people go through a lot of this, you know, a child is every bit worth the stress. Every last cent, of course, is typically worth it. I don't think couples out there regret the cost that it takes to go about it. It's just really important to think about those important steps from a financial point of view. So when you're sitting down with an advisor out there, you're earlier in life, just sitting down and talking about those goals, even if it doesn't seem like it should be a part of your financial plan, it should be. And those are the things that we can kind of take a look at and help you build financial-based goals on. And so if you've got questions about that, or if you want to take a look at her story, she wrote that blog post. So if you go to wealthwakeup.com and you go to under insights and blog posts, it's, I think, on the top few blog posts that she shared her story on. So check it out, wealthwakeup.com. And with that, we're going to go ahead and take a short break here. We'll be right back.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue, Camille Kolpenberg. We are live. We are here in studio. If you got questions for us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. I'm going to talk a little bit here about rates of returns, and going to start out talking about 10-year Treasury notes, which are essentially zero. Now, if you want to lump that in there, you can probably go ahead and lump in CD rates at the same time. But the real rate of return on a bond is calculated by subtracting the most recent inflation rate, such as a consumer price index, and the bond's current yield. The higher the real rate of return, the better. So let's take a look as of April 6th of this year. The yield on a benchmark 10-year T-note was 1.66%, or say 1.7% if you round it. That's matching the 1.7% trailing 12-month rate of the consumer price index in February of 2021. In other words, the cost of living was also up 1.7%, which is the most recent rate available. This equates to a real rate of return of zero, which is not attractive in our opinion. As a base level, in order to maintain one's purchasing power, bond investors have sought to generate a yield that at least outpaces the rate of inflation. For comparison purposes, from April 6th of 91 through April 6th of this year, that's the last 30 years, the average yield on the 10-year Treasury note was 4.2%, while the average rate on the consumer price index was 2.3% from the February 28th of 91 through February 28th of this year. According to Bloomberg, these figures translate into an average real rate of return of 1.9%, far more attractive than what is currently available. In September of last year, the Federal Reserve stated that it expects to hold short-term interest rates near zero, and two things happen. One, the U.S. unemployment rate is back to normal, around 4%, and two, inflation is running at or above 2%. The Fed has remained steadfast in its guidance despite the 115-point surge in the yield on the 10-year note since August 4th of last year, which at that time was an all-time low of 0.51%. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell commented on March 24th that he's not concerned about the rise in bond yields because he believes it reflects growing optimism about the economy's prospects, according to Wall Street Journal. I think it's important for you to keep these numbers in mind when you're out there looking at where am I going to invest my money, how am I going to make a return on it, And I know that safety is top priority for a lot of people. The part of safety is also getting a return on your money and not losing any purchasing power as you go along. I'm going to change directions here a little bit, though. Let's talk about five conversations that you need to have with your partner. Strong communication is important to ensure that each of you are on the same page regarding short and long-term goals. You know, in relationships, it's common for one partner to be a spender, one partner to be more of a saver. Neither is better or worse than the other, but it takes strong communication, more important to ensure that each partner is on the same page regarding short and long-term goals. So here's five conversations that you should have. One, what is your current financial situation? Money talks can be unaffordable, that partners are uncomfortable, not only maybe unaffordable too, but uncomfortable. But partners must be open and honest if they want their relationship to succeed. So once you get over that initial awkward stage, the conversation should flow more smoothly. Start by putting pen to paper on where both of you currently stand: cash on hand, current retirement, or investment accounts, approximate monthly spending, and outstanding loans or liabilities. And then the second question is, how can you improve your financial situation? Well, it's important to look for ways to maximize your combined net worth. Start by combing through your expenses. Ask yourself if you have any unnecessary spending that can be cut back or eliminated. Next, assess your ability to expedite the payoff of any outstanding debts, especially those that have higher interest rates. And finally, look at increasing your retirement savings by contributing more to your 401k or your IRA, or by starting to save in a general brokerage account that can be accessed at any time. And then take a look at, what are your career goals? Well, understanding each other's career aspirations is going to help give you insight into how finances may look long term. You should know if your partner has hopes of higher earning another degree, which may require emotional and possibly financial support. Or maybe one partner earns less but not now but expects to significantly more in the future. How might that affect your way to spend and save for retirement as a couple now down the road? Getting on that same page early is imperative. And then talk about how you're going to split expenses. You know, in time, as a relationship, a marriage goes on, it's easy to foster resentment over things like money. Having a discussion about how you're going to split your expenses can help prevent that resentment. Two most common ways of splitting expenses are to divide them 50-50, so if you divide them by an amount that is proportionate to your incomes. A great way to pay for joint expenses is to establish a joint account, regularly contribute a predetermined amount to that account. Setting the boundaries up front will put you both on ease when it comes time to pay the mortgage, the bills, or even a night out. And then how do you plan for big-ticket items? If it feels like there's no shortage of expensive items that you need to have, but major goals like a home, a wedding, adoption, surrogacy, those things, they must be discussed and planned for. Start by fully understanding the costs of each goal and timeline to fund it. Then open separate savings accounts for each goal and continue to be on a regular automated basis. These are certainly not the only money-related conversations that you should have, but it's a bare start. So seek guidance. This is something we as financial advisors, this is what we do, sit down and help you plan for these types of things. And then I had a short piece this week I thought was rather interesting. Most of us now are aware of the issues in Georgia over them passing voter laws down there. And, of course, we're seeing now that one in three Americans are watching less sports, and they're blaming the social justice preaching. When former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick first took a knee during the national anthem in 2016, something snapped in the cultural landscape. The act proved to be a flashpoint, sharply dividing Americans along two distinct battle lines. One side defended Kaepernick as a hero, bravely standing against the racist system oppressing minorities. The other viewed the act as a form of disrespect toward the country that gave him so much. Kaepernick would not be the last athlete to attempt to use his or her celebrity status to push a political agenda. Soccer star Megan Rapinoe has dedicated herself to competing for equal pay for women. NBA star LeBron James is now a pundit for everything from China to racism. And according to a new poll, all this political posturing is preaching is starting to have actual consequences for professional sports. Yahoo News and YouGov report that nearly 35% of Americans have started to watch less sports, especially due to the woke social justice messaging. It turns out people don't like being lectured about why they watch football, basketball, or other sports. In the past, sports acted as a place for people to come together. Liberals and conservatives could unite over their shared love of a game or cheer for their favorite team regardless of their political affiliation. When Mark Cuban, owner of the NBA Dallas Mavericks, announced his intentions to stop playing the national anthem before home games, there was a mass pushback from the right and big praise from the left. The national anthem is a song meant to unite the vast and disparate people of the country together under one banner, suddenly was becoming controversial. The decision last Friday by Major League Baseball to pull the All-Star game out of Georgia to protect reforms to improve election integrity also shows how much sway the left holds over our culture. Major League Baseball is virtue signaling by moving the game out of Atlanta based on family or faulty logic that the election for reforms are a form of voter suppression, but then moving it to Denver, Colorado, which also has voter ID laws, but which didn't make the headlines. Not to say that sports cannot carry political messaging. Jesse Owens, a black man, won 4 gold medals in the 1936 Olympics games hosted by Hitler's Nazi Germany in direct defiance of the evil race-based ideology driving the fascist state. The act was inherently political and unified Americans in their values. Owens was an American, not a Republican or a Democrat. That was all that mattered. In a world already full of things that divide us, a loss of even a single square foot of common ground can be devastating. But that Yahoo News YouGov poll does bring a sense of hope. Legendary NBA player Michael Jordan was once asked why he wasn't more vocal about his political views. His response, Republicans buy shoes too. As sport teams and their owners begin to reassess their strategies in response to a drop in viewership, that observation should be served as a guide. Conservatives are still here, and we still buy shoes. Okay, got one quick one over here, I guess. We're also seeing that small business is gaining optimism about the future. There's one area that's in doubt. This is done. Seattle Times published an article here based on U.S. Census data, concluded that there's optimism in Washington State that small business, that there were 50% of those that believe that the economy is going to return to normal within 6 months. On the surface, this sounds good. But some business segments, however, when you take time to dig into the data, you find out that the retail trade and hospitality industry is suffering heavily as a result of the continued lockdowns. That sector shows that retail and hospitality responded very differently to the survey. That 50% of those in the retail and hospitality industries believe that it'll be more than 6 months before they can see a return to normality, and another 20% think 4 months or more. And if you think businesses that responded, what you think will recover or already closed, it's close to 62% of them already are closed. The response makes sense given the lockdown restrictions that they are under. And so this business sector has really suffered. It's interesting to look at some of these numbers that are out there. Dick Donahue, Camille Copenberg with you as well. Wake Up Live here on KGMI. Don't forget our show tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. Give us a call if you've got questions, 360-733-1200. Thanks and have a great week.